very briefly introduce our three panelists. You have their bios in front of you, so I will not bore you. First of all, we're going to hear from Fred Starr, who is has long been affiliated with SAIS, founding chairman of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute and the Silk Road Studies Program. And he's been a research professor there for quite some time. What's not indicated on his bio is the fact that he has really provided a lot of intellectual heft, if not the intellectual inspiration, for the U.S. New Silk Road Initiative through works such as his book, The New Silk Roads, published in 2008. We'll next hear from Mara Burr, who is currently senior vice president at Albright Stonebridge Group. She was previously Deputy Assistant U.S. Trade Rep for South and Central Asian Affairs. And then, last but not least, we'll hear from Jan Kalitsky, who is a public policy scholar here at the Wilson Center. He previously was the Bill Clinton administration's ombudsman for energy and commercial cooperation with the new independent states. He also has held positions at Chevron and also some positions with Brown and Georgetown universities, among other places. I would ask, if not command, that our three panelists truncate their remarks just a bit. Try to keep them to 8-10 minutes to ensure that we have sufficient time for Q&A, and so that we don't have to keep you all here longer beyond schedule. So I'll invite Professor Starr.
Let me begin by underscoring what has been achieved by the so-called New Silk Road Initiative. Mention was made of APTA, the Afghan-Pakistan Trade and Transport Agreement. That is advancing in its implementation. It's agreed, but that it's advancing is a very big deal. Potentially opens up one of the biggest blockages in the region, and has implications, direct implications for all countries in Central Asia. Also, CASA 1000, the electric grid, has been discussed. That's a major achievement too. Hats off, especially to the World Bank on that. There are others that I want to just mention telegraphically. Getting Afghanistan into the international transport system, international road transport union, trade fairs, people-to-people meetings, women entrepreneurs, and all that. It's very positive, and I think hats off to Ms. Sumar and her staff for these significant achievements. There are also areas where there's been little progress or none. Aside from APTA, the Afghan-Pakistan agreement, which, after all, was signed quite a while back, Customs and Borders remains pretty much stillborn. And this is really important because every logistics firm in the world knows how long does it take to traverse each border. And therefore, the slow borders around Afghanistan are a huge impediment to all kinds of continental transport, and that must be addressed. We're not talking about all borders. We're only talking about a few key borders on corridors. And of the corridors that we're talking about, the key ones are east-west, namely one opening to Pakistan, one to Turkmenistan, and then two north to Tajikistan, one to Tajikistan, one to Uzbekistan, and on from there to Kazakhstan and so forth. Now, that issue is wide open still, and it's extremely important. Second, TAPI, that Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India gas pipeline, which Afghanistan's President Ghani calls its main potential driver for development. Solid planning's been done by ADB and regional governments and the U.S., but the key next step, namely to sign a deal and get on with it, is absolutely, for the moment, stalled. There were two U.S. firms that were actively involved with that. At this point, neither is. TAPI is dead for any U.S. firm for the time being, and for any serious U.S. role in making it happen. Let's admit that both of these tasks, both the borders and the TAPI, are really difficult challenges, and some claim TAPI is actually impossible, although the same was said of the Baku-Jehan pipeline back in the 90s. But here's the point. In both, we've been a rather quick our senior officials especially, to place the blame on others. For the borders often point to the fecklessness of the Afghans or the Uzbeks or the Tajiks or the Turkmen. And for TAPI, the blame gets laid squarely on the shoulders of the government of Turkmenistan. Maybe we ought to look at ourselves on this, too. Here's what I have in mind. Regarding the borders, let me just speak about the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan crossing. Why would the Turkmen have invested billions in the construction of new road and railroad from the Afghan border all the way to the Caspian, and why would it have invested billions more in building a modern port at Turkmenbashi if it did not consider its border to the east prime national importance? Similarly, this is a top priority for the government of Afghanistan. Indeed, if the Afghans don't get this opening fast border to Turkmenistan, they'll have no choice but to have their main window to the west via Iran. Will have created that. Neither the Afghans nor the Turkmen are fools, but they know that opening quick borders is not easy and requires for them the active participation and backing of some external third force that wishes them both well. Now, with regard to TAPI, recall that that it was Turkmenistan itself that initiated the important gas pipeline to China. In fact, the Chinese have said publicly they doubted it would ever have been built. But nonetheless, Hu Jintao had made multiple trips to Ashgabat to seal the deal. The Turkmens quite reasonably expected the U.S. government to take a similar top-level interest in TAPI. After all, nothing less than their security and sovereignty was at stake. I know from very high-level sources in Ashgabat that the impediments to the deal with Chevron could have been resolved and the deal signed had President Obama communicated his support and commitment to this project. He didn't, and the deal came apart. Moreover, however, in spite of what my friend Jan might say, TAPI is not dead. Only America's involvement has faded for the time being. But let me speak more generally about what seems to be the U.S. government's half-hearted support for its own lead project for post-2014 Afghanistan and Central Asia. All governments in the region support America's New Silk Road Initiative. They see them as productive, constructive, creating a kind of friendly balance, not a hostile balance, with other initiatives from their neighbors to the east and to the north. But they know that to date there has been no support or even involvement from the NSC, which we are told is totally focused on ISIS and Ukraine, even though NSC has increased its staff by 5 times to 250. The NSC has evidently not figured out how to walk and chew gum at the same time. Most important, there has not been one word of public support for its own New Silk Road project or even mention of the project as a whole from the White House. But beyond all this, the U.S. government's limited success in advancing its own program arises also from a more basic conceptual problem, which was committed at the very outset. It is focused, our government is focused almost entirely on the link between Pakistan and Afghanistan and Central Asia, India, of course, too. Washington has been stuck on this. This is an important link, and for all the reasons that we've heard today from Assistant Secretary Biswal. But we're stuck on it. Only recently has the State Department begun to look at the bigger and far more important task of connecting India and Europe via Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, and the Caucasus. In other words, the U.S. has only partially embraced the concept of continental transport that China correctly grasped from the outset. I just note that in the earlier presentation, we didn't hear the word Europe. I think twice I heard it mentioned. Caucasus, not at all, and continental, not at all. These are the key phrases. I'm speaking here about the so-called Southern Corridor. It stretches from India, really beyond that, Hamburg to Hanoi. It is older, longer, more heavily traveled, less frequently interrupted than the so-called Silk Road connecting China and Europe. The key, of course, is Afghanistan. Both of these corridors are essential. Both are urgently needed. And the link between them is essential. But the southern corridor is the one I'm focusing on here. The U.S. has already invested billions in Afghan transport, including road construction throughout the country and above all the ring road. But it has done so almost randomly without prioritizing its activities or identifying the necessary sequencing. Most of all, it has conceived the trade resulting from these projects in local or at best regional terms, not in their much more important dimension, which is continent-wide. Absent serious focus from the U.S., China has now taken this up. The Chinese even borrowed the name of the U.S. project for their own. Hats off to them. But it is no secret that China undertook its own New Silk Road project as much for geostrategic reasons as for possible economic benefits. Why? Well, because it can provide a land alternative to the West, to get to the West, if sea lanes are ever blocked. To this extent, China's monopolization of east-west transport routes could have unwelcome consequences. But China's New Silk Road initiative is positive. But the absence of open connectivity between Europe and India via Pakistan and Afghanistan creates severe geoeconomic imbalances at the heart of Eurasia. But I repeat, China's project, like ours and like the two together, makes solid economic sense. Regarding China's project, let me introduce here three very quick caveats. First, China began opening itself to Europe in 1993. It thus has a 20-year lead on the Southern Corridor. Second, the $40 billion that China has promised for this effort is a lot of money. But look at the investments already made in the Southern Corridor, and I have in mind investments by India and Japan, Pakistan and China, Afghanistan and the U.S. and India, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Turkey, and so on. Add it all up, it's much, much more than $40 billion already spent on the Southern Corridor. The Southern Corridor became a possibility only, this third point, only thanks to Operation Enduring Freedom. The U.S. invested 2,500 lives and $1 trillion in this. Would a wise person simply walk away from such an investment? This is what we're doing with the New Silk Road. If our support for the Southern Corridor remains half-hearted, it will threaten or kill President Ghani's two main economic initiatives and delay economic development in Afghanistan. The New Silk Road remains an absolutely valid concept and an important one. I say this in full recognition of the flaws in execution that I've spoken about and others on the panelists may discuss as well. Two secretaries of state have embraced the New Silk Road concept, but to date it remains more an aspiration than a reality. Nonetheless, in the longer term, it will be realized because it makes such solid economic sense, social sense, and geopolitical sense. And let me stress in closing that it is not against anyone. The New Silk Road, this great transport web involving all of Central Asia, all of South Asia, connecting to the West via diverse routes, especially through the Caucasus, and to the East by two main routes, one going to China, one going to India and Southeast Asia. This great web of transport that is now being reopened after hundreds of years of being closed, this is not against anyone. This is why all our friends in both Central Asia and the Caucasus, as well as in Afghanistan, support it. If we don't do the job, others will. Rest assured, it'll happen. But if we fail to take a role, a more active role, it will consign the U.S. to the status of bystander to the heart of Central Asia. We should not put ourselves in such a position. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Maura Burr?
Sure. I think I'll address you from here. I'm glad the map is up. That's helpful. So in my experience in working with Central Asia and South Asia, I sort of view it as we talk about a new Silk Road. I was talking to Fred and Jan before. No one's actually said where it started or where it ends, so it's kind of hard to build a road. So that's been always a difficulty with this concept. Nevertheless, the larger concept of connecting Central Asia and connecting South Asia and then connecting the two together has always been a laudable goal. And I think it's important to note, at least on the economic side of it, that the United States' trade with Central Asia is pretty paltry compared to our trade with the rest of the world. There is investment, certainly in oil and gas, in some other sectors in the region, and I think it would be great for opportunities for U.S. companies to have more investment there. But it's certainly not a huge economic driver. It's not as if the U.S. is looking to plant itself in Central Asia. This is an idea that is really about connecting countries that have historically not had particularly good ties and certainly not trade and investment ties, and also connect those countries with the countries of South Asia where the situation is pretty much the same. If you look at some of the impediments on this bumpy road, and you think of speed bumps on a road, and some are normal size and some are Everest size, how do you deal with those types of impediments if you're trying to build a road? And I think some of it, certainly you look at infrastructure. The infrastructure in many of these countries is very old, or it's never really been up to what we would consider proper infrastructure for ease of movement for goods, especially, but goods and services. If you look at internet connections and ability to access the internet, that's also an important element of trade these days. Services are done cross-border. They're done over the internet. If you don't have good internet connections, if you don't have access to energy, those types of activities are very limited. There's also numerous legal and regulatory issues that cause problems for countries to have better trade and investment regimes. In some cases, it may take you a good half a year to navigate what some of the requirements are to invest in a country. And if you are an investor from a certain country that country doesn't particularly like very much, well, you can go to the end of the line. And so those historic problems within the regions have also caused a lack of willingness to promote connectivity, to promote trade, to promote investment. I think you saw the slide with the delays. If you're shipping perishable goods, are you going to wait 86 days? It doesn't even make sense. So, no. I mean, trade and agriculture, pretty much not possible. And so if you take out the big sectors, you're looking at enormous difficulties in improving the trade ties between the countries and being able to take advantage of markets that should be close, should be relatively cheap, and should take the benefit from reduced transport costs. There's also just tariff and non-tariff barriers. The customs regimes are, in some cases, more than antiquated. Let's put it on the table. Corruption is a huge issue in many of these countries, and it's a problem that continues to undermine the ability of countries to, not only to work with each other, but the private sector to become active in those countries. I think it's also important to note that perhaps the biggest single impediment that I've seen to connectivity, to greater connectivity in Central Asia and in South Asia and between the two, is a lack of political will and a lack of common purpose between the countries. And I think my colleague, Professor Starr, has made a good point. In order to build that common will and common purpose, there needs to be leadership. Is that leadership going to come from the United States? Is that leadership going to come from Russia? Is that leadership going to come from China? These are open questions. Are we willing to devote high-level resources to conduct some of this really important shuttle diplomacy, if you will, to get countries on the same page about the legal and regulatory changes that they need to undertake. Over the past few years, one of the areas, at least that we've seen as a positive in Central Asia, is the move toward accession to the World Trade Organization. This is an important Kazakhstan, and my good friend Ambassador Mert knows very well. We've worked on many aspects of accession with Kazakhstan. We were able to help Tajikistan accede in 2013. Afghanistan was on a bit of a fast track to accede until the elections, and it's gone a little bit slower now. But if you have a Central Asia that adopts a common set of principles, a common legal regime, a tariff structure that is published and transparent, and implements the newly minted and enforced trade facilitation agreement that is meant to have countries have some introspection about what their customs problems are, both on the infrastructure side and on the investment side, you have the potential to address some of the biggest speed bumps on the Silk Road. And there's an important element in addition to the transit union and the joining to that, allowing trucks to cross borders. There's also in the WTO Article 5 of the GATT, and it allows transit rights, and it is an obligation of WTO members to allow goods to transit their frontier from other WTO members, subject to dispute settlement. And this is an important aspect of WTO accession and commitment to obligations to the multilateral trading system. In South Asia, most of the countries are WTO members. As I said, Afghanistan is in the process of accession. And hopefully this will bring about a common legal and regulatory system for the countries to agree upon that will set the stage for at least greater trade and transport integration. But we've yet to see sort of a critical mass on the Central Asian side. We have two of the five that are in, and we hope to see Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan think concretely about moving forward. I think with that, it's important to take a look at one other regional entity, and it's been touched upon before, but the Eurasian Economic Union and the Russian-Belarus-Kazakhstan Customs Union. It's unclear if this is going to be a net positive for the region or not. It's important to note with the problems in the Russian economy that the Eurasian Economic Union has become a little less attractive to certain countries that perhaps were interested. And so it will be interesting in the next year to see how that develops, and essentially, you know, if countries are willing to take the WTO route or others to at least allow the underpinnings of what would be a legal and regulatory framework to address some of these major speed bumps on the new Silk Road. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mara. Jan?
I'll try to be brief. Fred and Mara covered a lot of ground here, and my assignment is energy. Let me just make a few points about this. First, about the role of energy. Secondly, distinguishing a bit between the northern and southern part of Central Asia. And third, the U.S. policy implications that I see. First of all, the role of energy. We've talked about electric power, which is very important. Clearly, oil and gas are very important in the region as a whole. The preponderance of oil and gas resources being in the north in Kazakhstan, in the south in Turkmenistan, but there is some gas in Uzbekistan, and certainly hydropower is a very significant factor, including for Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. So very important, and it's important not only in economic terms, it's important in terms of maintaining the economic independence and security of these countries. This is not just an economic issue. It's a geopolitical issue. So energy equals a lot more than simply providing the necessary commodities to the necessary markets, and we all understand that. Clearly the leaders of the region understand that. Second, differentiation between northern and southern part of Central Asia. If you think about the Caspian, you think about the western part of the Caspian, where Azerbaijan has its access through Georgia directly to the Turkish and Western markets, it's a very different proposition from the eastern Caspian, which really has to rely on transit through very problematic areas. And historically, as we all know, this has included especially the then Soviet Union, now the Russian Federation. I think the most important thing to understand here is that countries such as Kazakhstan have been able to effectively manage this problematic relationship through diversification of routes. The diversification is extended from rail lines, which are a very important element, barging of material across the Caspian, to, very importantly, the pipelines themselves. And instead of relying simply on the Russian state pipeline company Transneft, we have a public-private initiative, the Caspian Pipeline Consortium, the CPC pipeline, which includes a number of companies, including led by Chevron on the western side, but also includes the Russian and Kazakh governments. Very important hybrid, full of headaches for the people managing the this wonderful structure, but very important politically for making sure that Kazakhstan has the variety of access to the markets that it seeks. If you then look to the south, to Turkmenistan, it's quite a different story. Here you have a country which has been by and large dominated by Chinese investment in its markets in terms of developing and in terms of transiting the gas resource. And I think the Chinese model is a very interesting one from a commercial as well as a political point of view, because it's a state-packaged approach in which you take responsibility for all of the infrastructure, all of the resource development, all of the pipelines, and you could provide substantial credits in addition to that. It's a state-packaged deal. In contrast to the Western approach, which is commercially driven, very much relying on project development and resource development. And from the Turkmen standpoint, that contrast has spoken volumes. Having said that, Turkmenistan wants to have a variety of market avenues, and I think Fred was right. I don't think that TAPI is dead, but I think TAPI is full of problems, as is obvious to anybody looking at a map. But Turkmenistan does want to have that access to international markets. And during my time in the Clinton administration, I beat my head against the wall many times with Turkmenbashi at that time, trying to talk about gas transportation across the Caspian. I think fundamentally it still is a good idea, but its time has not come. And the reason I think that is that Azerbaijan, for example, has signaled very clearly that it is prepared to talk about resource development in the Caspian, irrespective of the territorial dispute with Turkmenistan. That's a very important signal. On the other hand, Turkmenistan sees problems in the approach with Azerbaijan, and very importantly, it would have big implications vis-a-vis Russia. And that brings me really to the policy implications for the U.S. and, for that matter, the European Union. I think it's a very important policy position that was developed in the 90s and maintained to support transit through and around Russia. Russia is there. It's a reality. It has to be worked with. And the fact that we have pipeline arrangements working with Transneft, working side by side with CPC and the like, are very important so that the Russians understand that there is a commitment to their own positive role in the region. But it's also important that we have pipeline arrangements that are separate from Russia. And, of course, the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline is exhibit A, if you will, for that approach. But the fact that Kazakhstan is developing pipeline arrangements with China, I think, is very important. And I think that that diversification of pipelines is an important signal in addition to the one that says this is not a zero-sum game. This is a positive effort to have relationships, transit relationships, with the major countries in the area. The Chinese challenge is very much there. Is it going to be a cooperative arrangement, or is it going to be one that's more competitive? The jury is out, and I think part of it has to do simply with our commercial and strategic philosophy of how we go about doing business. It's as I said earlier, it's a very different approach. And in turn, it means not simply making nice noises about the Chinese and Russian roles in the area, but actually implementing and showing through our actions. I'm talking about this collectively, Russian actions, Chinese actions, American, European, regional actions, that there are practical ways in which we can cooperate with each other. And then, finally, I have to conclude that I was whispering to Mara, where is the I word? You know, there is a country called Iran, and it hasn't been talked about enough. We hope very much for a successful negotiation with Iran on the nuclear issues. Let's say, for argument's sake, that there is a successful outcome, and I very much hope there will be on the Iran nuclear side. The regional opportunities then would become enormous, ranging from transit arrangements to Iran. I'm talking about all transit arrangements of the kind that Fred was talking about earlier, to specific transit arrangements involving energy. The idea of swaps, where you supply the northern part of the country and the southern part of Iran, then exports to the international market. The idea of Iranian gas exports to India and Pakistan. The idea maybe even of the Iranians changing their truculent approach to the Caspian territorial issues, where all of the other Caspian states seem to have come to an understanding with the Iranians for rather obvious national reasons don't like the idea. Maybe you can come up with a broader approach which is cooperative and helps the whole area. And let me conclude by saying leadership, and I agree very much with Mara and Fred on this, leadership counts. The fact that the president of the Russian Federation spends a lot of his time in the capitals of this region, the fact that the president of China spends a lot of time in the capitals of this region, and the fact that the president of the United States does not, speaks volumes. And I'm all for the assistant secretary and wish her well, but she needs top-level cover here. We don't even have the vice president going there that much. Why not? If we're that interested and that concerned about this area, there are countries besides Afghanistan that count, and I think we ought to be showing through our presence and our engagement right at the top level that this matters.